Molly trudges up the road toward Vivian's from the bus stop, her laptop in her backpack, red Breeden slung over one shoulder, and Hawaiian Ashley on the other. The duffels are knocking into each other like rowdy patrons at a bar, with Molly stuck between. It's slow going. Before the blow-up with Dina, Molly had planned to go to Vivian's tomorrow to tell her what she found at the library. Well, plans change. Leaving was anticlimactic. Dina stayed behind her shut bedroom door with the TV blaring, while Ralph lamely offered to help Molly with her bags, loan her a 20, drive her somewhere. Molly almost said thank you, almost gave him a hug, but in the end she just barked, "No, I'm fine, see ya," and propelled herself forward by thinking, "This is already over. I am already gone." Occasionally a car lumbers past. This being the off-season, most cars on the road are sensible Subarus, 10-ton trucks, or clunkers. Molly's wearing her heavy winter coat because, though it's May, this is, after all, Maine. And who knows, she might end up sleeping in it. She left behind heaps of stuff for Ralph and Dina to deal with, including a few hideous synthetic sweaters Dina had tossed her way at Christmas. Good riddance. Molly counts her steps, left, right, left, right, left, right, left, right. Her left shoulder hurts, strap digging into bone. She jumps in place, shifting the straps. Now it's sliding down. Shit, jump again. She's a turtle carrying its shell. Jane Eyre, staggering across the heath. A Penobscot under the weight of a canoe. Of course her load is heavy. These bags contain everything she possesses in the world. What do you carry with you? What do you leave behind? Gazing ahead at the dark blue sky striated with clouds, Molly reaches up and touches the charms around her neck. Raven, bear, fish. The turtle on her hip. She doesn't need much. And even if she loses the charms, she thinks, they'll always be a part of her. The things that matter stay with you, seep into your skin. People get tattoos to have a permanent reminder of things they love or believe or fear. But though she'll never regret the turtle, she has no need to ink her flesh again to remember the past. She had not known the markings would be etched so deep. Approaching Vivian's house, Molly looks at her phone. It's later than she thought it would be, 8:54. The fluorescent overhead bulb on the porch gives off a dim pink light. The rest of the house is dark. Molly heaves her bags onto the porch, rubs her shoulders for a minute, then walks around to the back, the bayside, peering up at the windows for any sign of life. And there it is. On the second floor of the far right side, two windows glow. Vivian's bedroom. Molly isn't sure what to do. She doesn't want to scare Vivian, and now that she's here, she realizes that even ringing the doorbell would startle her at this hour. So she decides to call. Gazing up at Vivian's window, she dials her number. "Hello? Who is it?" Vivian answers after four rings in a strained, too loud voice, as if communicating with someone far out at sea. "Hi, Vivian, it's Molly." "Molly? Is that you?" "Yes," she says, her voice cracking. She takes a deep breath. "Steady. Stay calm. I'm sorry to bother you." Vivian comes into view in the window, pulling a burgundy robe over her nightgown. "What's the matter? Are you all right?" "Yes, I..." "Goodness! Do you know what hour it is?" Vivian says, fussing with the cord. "I'm so sorry to call this late. I didn't know what else to do." There's silence on the other end as Vivian absorbs this. "Where are you?" she says finally, perching on the arm of a chair. "I'm downstairs. Outside. I mean, I was afraid it would alarm you if I rang the bell." "You're where?" "Here. I'm here. At your house." "Here? Now?" Vivian stands up. "I'm sorry." And then Molly can't help it. She starts to cry. It's cold on the grass, and her shoulders ache, and Vivian is freaked out, and the Island Explorer is done for the night, and the garage is dark and creepy, and there's nowhere else in the world she can think of to go. "Don't cry, dear. Don't cry. I'll be right down." "Okay." Molly heaves in a breath. "Pull yourself together." "I'm hanging up now.
Okay.
Through her tears, Molly watches Vivian replace the receiver on the hook, wrap her robe tighter and tie it, pat the silver hair at the nape of her neck. As Vivian leaves the bedroom, Molly runs back to the front porch. She shakes her head to clear it, pulls her bags into a neat heap, wipes her eyes and nose with a corner of her t-shirt. A moment later, Vivian opens the door. She looks with alarm from Molly, who realizes that, despite wiping her eyes, she must have mascara smeared all over her face, to the bulky duffel bags, to the overstuffed backpack. "For goodness sake, come in," she says, holding the door wide. "Come in this minute and tell me what happened." Despite Molly's protests, Vivian insists on making tea. She takes down a cabbage rose teapot and cups, a wedding gift from Mrs. Murphy that's been in a box for decades, along with some recently recovered spoons from Mrs. Nielsen's silver service. They wait in the kitchen for the water to boil, and then Molly pours water in the teapot and carries the tea service to the living room on a tray, with some cheese and crackers Vivian has found in the pantry. Vivian turns on two lamps and settles Molly in a red wingback. Then she goes over to the closet and takes out a quilt. "The wedding ring," Molly says. Vivian holds the quilt by two corners and shakes it out, then carries it over and drapes it across Molly's lap. It is stained and ripped in places, thinned from use. Many of the small rectangles of fabric sewn by hand into interlocking circles have dissolved altogether. The ghostly remains of stitches holding snippets of colored cloth. "If I can't bear to give this stuff away, I might as well use it." As Vivian tucks the quilt around her legs, Molly says, "Sorry for barging in like this." Vivian flaps her hand. "Don't be silly. I could use the excitement. Gets my heart rate up. I'm not sure that's a good thing." The news about Maisie sits in Molly's stomach like a stone. She doesn't want to spring it on Vivian just yet. Too many surprises at once. After Vivian has poured tea in two cups, handed one to Molly, taken one for herself, added and stirred in two lumps of sugar, and arranged the cheese and crackers on the plate, she settles into the other chair and folds her hands on her lap. "All right," she says. "Now tell me." So Molly talks. She tells Vivian about living in the trailer on Indian Island, the car crash that killed her father, her mother's struggle with drugs. She shows her Shelley the turtle. She tells her about the dozen foster homes and the nose ring and the argument with Dina and finding out on the internet that her mother's in jail. The tea grows tepid, then cold in their cups. And then, because she is determined to be completely honest, Molly takes a deep breath and says, "There's something I should have told you a long time ago. The community service requirement wasn't for school. It was because I stole a book from the Spruce Harbor Library." Vivian pulls her burgundy fleece robe tighter around her. "I see. It was a stupid thing to do. What book was it?" "Jane Eyre." "Why did you steal it?" Molly thinks back to that moment, pulling each copy of the novel off the shelf, turning them over in her hands, returning the hardcover and the newer paperback, tucking the other one under her shirt. "Well, it's my favorite book, and there were three copies. I thought nobody would miss the crappiest one." She shrugs. "I just wanted to own it." Vivian taps her bottom lip with her thumb. "Terry knew?" Molly shrugs. She doesn't want to get Terry in trouble. "Jack vouched for me, and you know how she feels about Jack." "That I do." The night is still, quiet except for their voices. The drapes are shut against the dark. "I'm sorry I came into your house this way, under false pretenses," Molly says. "Ah, well," Vivian says, "I suppose we all come under false pretenses one way or another, don't we? It was best not to tell me. I probably wouldn't have let you in." Clasping her hands together, she says, "If you're going to steal a book, though, you should at least take the nicest one. Otherwise, what's the point?" Molly is so nervous she barely smiles. But Vivian does. "Stealing Jane Eyre," she laughs. "They should have given you a gold star, bumped you up a grade." "You're not disappointed in me?" Vivian lifts her shoulders. "Really?" Relief washes over her. You've certainly paid your dues. In any case, putting in all these hours with me, it hasn't felt like punishment. Once upon a time, fairly recently, in fact, Molly would have gagged over these words, both because they're blatantly sycophantic and cringingly sentimental. But not today. For one thing, she means them. For another, she's so focused on the next part of the story that she can barely think of anything else. She plunges ahead. "Listen, Vivian," she says, "there's something else I need to tell you." "Oh, Lord." Vivian takes a sip of cold tea and sets her cup down. "What have you done now?" Molly takes a deep breath. "It's not about me. It's about Maisie." Vivian gazes at her steadily, her hazel eyes clear and unblinking. "I went online. I just wanted to see if I could find anything, and it was surprisingly easy. I found records from Ellis Island."
"The Agnes Pauline?"
"Yeah, exactly. I found your parents' names on the roster, and from there I got the death notices of your father and brothers, but not hers. Not Maisie's. And then I had the idea to try to find the Schatzmans. Well, there happened to be a family reunion blog, and... anyway, it said that they adopted a baby, Margaret, in 1929. Vivian is perfectly still.
"Margaret."
Molly nods.
"Maisie.
It has to be, right?
But he told me she didn't make it."
"I know." Vivian seems to gather herself up, to grow taller in her chair.
"He lied to me."
For a moment she looks off in the middle distance, somewhere above the bookcase. Then she says,
"And they adopted her?"
"Apparently so. I don't know anything else about them, though I'm sure there are ways to find out. But she lived a long time. In upstate New York, she only died 6 months ago. There's a photo. She seemed really happy. Children and grandchildren and all that." "God, I'm an idiot," Molly thinks. "Why did I say that?"
"How do you know she died?"
"There's an obituary. I'll show you, and... do you want to see the photo?" Without waiting for an answer, Molly gets up and retrieves her laptop from her backpack. She turns it on and brings it over to where Vivian is sitting. She opens the family reunion photos and the obituary, saved on her desktop, and places the laptop in Vivian's lap. Vivian peers at the picture on the screen.
"That's her."
Looking up at Molly, she says, "I can tell by the eyes. They're exactly the same." "She looks like you," Molly says. And they both stare silently for a moment at the beaming elderly woman with sharp blue eyes, surrounded by her family. Vivian reaches out and touches the screen.
"Look at how white her hair is.
It used to be blonde.
Ringlets."
She twirls her index finger next to her own silver head.
"All these years, she was alive,"
she murmurs.
"Maisie was alive. All these years, there were two of them."
Minneapolis, Minnesota, 1939. It is late September of my 19th year, and two new friends, Lillian Bart and Emily Reese, want me to go with them to see a new picture that's playing at the Orpheum Theater in Minneapolis, The Wizard of Oz. It's so long it has an intermission, and we've made plans to stay the night. Lillian's fiancé lives there, and she goes almost every weekend, staying in a hotel for women. It's a safe, clean place, she assures us, that doesn't cost much money, and she has booked three single rooms. I've only been to the Twin Cities on day trips with the Nielsens, for a special birthday dinner, a shopping expedition, one afternoon at the art museum, but never with friends, and never overnight. I'm not sure I want to go. For one thing, I haven't known these girls for long. They're both in my night class at St. Olaf. They live together in an apartment near the college. When they talk about drinks parties, I'm not even sure what they mean. Parties where you have only drinks? The only party the Nielsens host is an annual open house buffet lunch on New Year's Day for their vendors. Lillian, with her friendly expression and golden blonde hair, is easier to like than the arch and circumspect Emily, who has a funny half-smile and severe dark bangs and is always making jokes I don't get. Their racy humor, raucous laughter, and breezy, unearned intimacy with me make me a little nervous. For another thing, a big shipment of fall fashions is coming into the store today or tomorrow, and I don't want to return to find all of it in the wrong places. Mr. Nielsen has arthritis, and though he still comes in early every morning, he usually leaves around 2 to take an afternoon nap. Mrs. Nielsen is in and out. Much of her time these days is taken up with bridge club and volunteering at the church. But she encourages me to go with Lillian and Emily, saying, "A girl your age should get out now and then. There's more to life than the store and your studies, Vivian. Sometimes I worry you forget that." When I graduated from high school, Mr. Nielsen bought me a car, a white Buick convertible, which I mainly drive to the store and St. Olaf in the evenings, and Mr. Nielsen says it'll be good for the car to run it a little.
"I'll pay for parking," he says.
As we drive out of town, the sky is the saccharine blue of a baby blanket, filled with puffy cotton ball clouds. It's clear before we're 10 miles down the road that Emily and Lillian's plans are more ambitious than they've let on. Yes, we'll go to the Wizard of Oz, but not the evening show that was the excuse for staying over. There's a matinee at 3 o'clock that will leave plenty of time to return to our rooms and dress to go out. "Wait a minute," I say. "What do you mean go out?" Lillian, sitting beside me in the passenger seat, gives my knee a squeeze. "Come on, you didn't think we'd drive all this way just to go to a silly picture show, did you?" From the back seat, where she's thumbing through Silver Screen magazine, Emily says, "So serious, Viv. You need to lighten up. Hey, do you girls know that Judy Garland was born in Grand Rapids? Named Frances Ethel Gum. Guess that wasn't Hollywood enough." Lillian smiles over at me. "You've never been to a nightclub, have you?" I don't answer, but of course she's right. She tilts the rearview mirror away from me and starts to apply lipstick. "That's what I thought. We are going to have some real fun for a change." Then she smiles, her glossy pink lips framing small white teeth. "Starting with cocktails." The women's hotel on a Minneapolis side street is just as Lillian described it, with a clean but sparsely furnished lobby and a bored clerk who barely looks up when he hands us our keys. Standing at the elevator with our bags, we plan to meet for the picture show in 15 minutes. "Don't be late," Emily admonishes. "We have to get popcorn. There's always a line." After dropping my bag in the closet of my narrow room on the 4th floor, I sit on the bed and bounce a few times. The mattress is thin, with creaky springs, but I feel a thrill of pleasure. My trips with the Nielsens are controlled, unambitious outings. A silent car ride, a specific destination, a sleepy ride home in the dark. Mr. Nielsen sitting erect in the front seat, Mrs. Nielsen beside him, keeping a watchful eye on the center line. Emily is standing alone in the lobby when I come downstairs. When I ask where Lillian is, she gives me a wink. "She's not feeling so well. She'll meet us after." As we make our way to the theater, 5 blocks away, it occurs to me that Lillian never had any intention of going to the picture with us. The Wizard of Oz is magical and strange. Black and white farmland gives way to a technicolor dreamscape, as vivid and unpredictable as Dorothy Gale's real life is ordinary and familiar. When she returns to Kansas, her heartfelt wish granted, the world is black and white again. "It's good to be home," she says. Back on the farm, her life stretches ahead to the flat horizon line, already populated with the only characters she'll ever know. When Emily and I leave the theater, it is early evening. I was so absorbed in the movie that real life feels slightly unreal. I have the uncanny sense of having stepped out of the screen and onto the street. The evening light is soft and pink, the air as mild as bathwater. Emily yawns.
"Well, that was long."
I don't want to ask, but manners compel me. "What did you think?" She shrugs.
"Those flying monkeys were creepy. But other than that, I don't know, I thought it was kind of boring."
We walk along in silence, past darkened department store windows. "What about you?" she says after a few minutes. "Did you like it?"
I loved the movie so much that I don't trust myself to respond without sounding foolish. Yes, I say, unable to translate into speech the emotion swirling through me. Back in my room, I change into my other outfit, a chiffon skirt and floral blouse with butterfly sleeves. I brush my hair over my head and toss it back, then shape it with my fingers and spray it with lacquer. Standing on my toes, I look at my reflection in the small mirror above the bed. In the late afternoon light, I look scrubbed and serious. Every freckle on my nose is visible. Taking out a small zippered bag, I spread butter-soft moisturizer on my face, then foundation. A smear of rouge, a pat of powder. I slide a brown pencil along my upper eyelids and feather my lashes. Apply Terra Coral lipstick, then blot my lips, apply it again, and tuck the gold vial in my purse. I scrutinize myself in the mirror. I'm still me, but I feel braver somehow. Down in the lobby, Lillian is holding hands with a guy I recognize as her fiancé, Richard, from the photograph she keeps in her purse. He's shorter than I expected, shorter than Lillian. Acne scars pock his cheeks. Lillian's wearing a sleeveless emerald shift dress, hemmed just above the knee, which is 3 inches shorter than anyone wears in Hemmingford, and black kitten heels. Richard yanks her close, whispers in her ear, and her eyes go wide. She covers her mouth and giggles, then sees me. "Vivi," she says, tearing herself away. "Look at you! I don't think I've ever seen you with makeup. You clean up nice." "You too," I say, though actually I've never seen her without. "How was the movie?" "It was good. Where were you?" She glances at Richard. "I got waylaid." They both start to giggle again.
"That's one way to put it," he says.
"You must be Richard," I say.
"How'd you guess?"
He claps me on the shoulder to show he's kidding around.
"You ready for some fun tonight, Vivi?"
"Well, I sure am." Emily's voice comes from over my shoulder, and I smell jasmine and roses. Joy, I recognize from the perfume counter at Nielsen's. Turning to greet her, I'm startled by her low-cut white blouse and tight, striped skirt, her teetering heels and crimson nail polish.
"Hello, Em,"
Richard grins.
"The fellas are sure going to be happy to see you."
I am suddenly self-conscious in my prim blouse and modest skirt, my sensible shoes and churchy earrings. I feel like exactly what I am, a small-town girl in the big city. Richard has his arms around both girls now, pinching them on the waist, laughing as they squirm. I glance at the desk clerk, the same one who was here when we checked in. It's been a long day for him, I think. He's leafing through a newspaper and only looks up when there's a raucous burst of laughter. I can see the headline from here. "Germans and Soviets parade in Poland."
"I'm getting thirsty, girls. Let's find a watering hole," Richard says.
My stomach is rumbling. "Should we get dinner first?"
"If you insist, Miss Vivi. The Barnuts would do it for me. What about you girls?"
he asks the other two.
"Now, Richard, this is Viv's first time in the city. She's not used to your decadent ways. Let's get some food," Lillian says. "Besides, it might be risky for us lightweights to start drinking on an empty stomach."
"Risky how?"
He pulls her closer, and Lillian smirks, then pushes him away, making her point.
All right,"
he says, making a show of his acquiescence.
"At the Grand Hotel, there's a piano bar that serves chow. I seem to remember a pretty good T-bone, and I know they got a nice martini."
We make our way out onto the street, now humming with people. It's a perfect evening. The air is warm. The trees along the avenue are swathed in deep green leaves. Flowers spill out of planters, slightly overgrown and a bit wild, here at the furthest edge of summer. As we stroll along, my spirits lift. Mingling in this wide swath of strangers shifts my attention from myself, that tedious subject, to the world around me. I might as well be in a foreign country for all its similarities to my sober real life, with its predictable routines and rhythms. A day in the store, supper at 6, a quiet evening of studying or quilting or bridge. Richard, with his carnival barker slickness, seems to have given up on even trying to include me. But I don't mind. It is marvelous to be young on a big city street.
As we approach the heavy glass and brass front door of the Grand Hotel, a liveried doorman opens it wide. Richard sails in with Lil and M, as he calls them, on his arms, and I scurry behind in their wake. The doorman tips his cap as I thank him.
"Bars on the left, just through the foyer,"
he says, making it clear he knows we're not hotel guests. I've never been in a space this majestic, except maybe the Chicago train station all those years ago. And it's all I can do not to gape at the starburst chandelier glittering over our heads, the glossy mahogany table with an oversized ceramic urn filled with exotic flowers in the center of the room. The people in the foyer are equally striking. A woman wearing a flat black hat with a net that covers half her face stands at the reception desk with a pile of red leather suitcases, pulling off one long black satin glove and then the other. A white-haired matron carries a fluffy white dog with black button eyes. A man, in a morning coat, talks on the telephone at the front desk. An older gentleman, wearing a monocle, sitting alone on a green love seat, holds a small brown book open in front of his nose. These people look bored, amused, impatient, self-satisfied, but most of all, they look rich. Now I am glad not to be wearing the gaudy, provocative clothing that seems to be drawing stares and whispers to Lil and M. Ahead of me, the three of them saunter across the lobby, shrieking with laughter, one of Richard's arms around Lil's shoulder and the other cinching M's waist. "Hey, Vivi!" Lil calls out, glancing back as if suddenly remembering I'm here. "This way!" Richard pulls open the double doors to the bar, throws his hands into the air with a flourish, and ushers Lil and M, giggling and whispering, inside. He follows, and the doors close slowly behind him. I slow to a stop in front of the green couches. I'm in no hurry to go in there to be a fifth wheel, treated like I'm hopelessly out of it, old-fashioned and humorless by the freewheeling Richard. Maybe I think I should just walk around for a while and then go back to the rooming house. Since the matinee, nothing has felt quite real anyway. It's been enough of a day for me, much more certainly than I'm used to. I perch on one of the couches, watching people come and go. At the door now is a woman in a purple satin dress with cascading brown hair, elegantly nonchalant, waving at the porter with a bejeweled hand as she glides into the foyer. Absorbed in watching her as she floats past me toward the concierge desk, I don't notice the tall, thin man with blonde hair until he is standing in front of me. His eyes are piercing blue.
"Excuse me, miss,"
he says. I wonder if maybe he is going to say something about how I am so obviously out of place, or ask if I need help.
"Do I know you from somewhere?"
I look at his golden blonde hair. Short in the back, but longer in the front. Nothing like the small-town boys I'm used to, with their hair shorn like sheep. He's wearing gray pants, a crisp, white shirt, and a black tie and carrying a slim attaché case. His fingers are long and tapered. "I don't think so."
"Something about you is very familiar."
He's staring at me so intently that it makes me blush. I stammer. "I really don't know." And then, with a smile playing around his lips, he says,
"Forgive me if I'm wrong, but did you come here on a train from New York about 10 years ago?"
What? My heart jumps. How does he know that?
"Are you Neve?"
he asks. And then I know. Oh my God, Dutchie. It's you!
Minneapolis, Minnesota, 1939. Dutchie drops the attaché case as I stand up and sweeps me into a hug. I feel the ropey hardness of his arms, the warmth of his slightly concave chest as he holds me tight, tighter than anyone has ever held me. A long embrace in the middle of this fancy lobby is probably inappropriate. People are staring, but for once in my life, I don't care. He pushes me away to look at my face, touches my cheek, and pulls me close again. Through his chambray shirt, I feel his heart racing as fast as mine.
"When you blushed, I knew. You looked just the same."
He runs his hand down my hair, stroking it like a pelt.
"Your hair? It's darker.
I can't tell you how many times I've looked for you in a crowd, or thought I saw you from the back.
You told me you'd find me, I say. Remember? It was the last thing you said.
I wanted to. I tried. But I didn't know where to look. And then so much happened.
He shakes his head in disbelief.
Is it really you, Neve?
Well, yes. But I'm not Neve anymore, I tell him. I'm Vivian.
I'm not Dutchie either. Or Hans, for that matter. I'm Luke.
We both start laughing at the absurdity of our shared experience, the relief of recognition. We cling to each other like survivors of a shipwreck, astonished that neither of us drowned. The many questions I want to ask render me mute. Before I can even formulate words, Dutchie, Luke, says,
"This is crazy, but I have to leave. I have a gig."
"A gig?"
"I play piano in the bar here. It's not a terrible job, if nobody gets too drunk."
"I was just on my way in there," I tell him. "My friends are waiting for me. They're probably drunk as we speak." He picks up his case.
"I wish we could just blow out of here," he says. "Go somewhere and talk."
I do too, but I don't want him to risk his job for me. "I'll stay till you're done. We can talk later."
"It'll kill me to wait that long."
When I enter the bar with him, Lil and Em look up, curiosity on their faces. The room is dark and smoky, with plush purple carpeting patterned with flowers and purple leather banquettes filled with people.
"That's the way to do it, girl," Richard says. "You sure didn't waste any time."
I sink into a chair at their table, order a gin fizz at the waiter's suggestion, and concentrate on Dutchie's fingers, which I can see from where I'm sitting, deftly skimming the piano keys. Ducking his head and closing his eyes, he sings in a clear, low voice. He plays Glenn Miller and Artie Shaw and Glenn Gray, music that everybody knows, songs like Little Brown Jug and Heaven Can Wait, rearranged to draw out different meanings, and some old standards for the gray-haired men on bar stools. Every now and then he pulls sheet music from his case, but mostly he seems to play from memory or by ear. A small cluster of older ladies clutching pocketbooks, their hair carefully coiffed, probably on a shopping expedition from some province or suburb, smile and coo when he tinkles the opening of Moonlight Serenade. Conversation washes over me, slips around me, snagging now and then when I'm expected to answer a question or laugh at a joke. I'm not paying attention. How can I? Dutchie is talking to me through the piano, and as in a dream, I understand his meaning. I have been so alone on this journey, cut off from my past. However hard I try, I will always feel alien and strange. And now I've stumbled on a fellow outsider, one who speaks my language without saying a word. The more people drink, the more requests they make, and the fuller Dutchie's tip jar grows. Richard's head is buried in Lil's neck, and Em is practically sitting in the lap of a gray hair who wandered over from the bar. "Over the rainbow," she calls out, several gin fizzes to the wind. "You know that one? From that movie?" Dutchie nods, smiles, spreads his fingers across the keys. By the way he plays the chords, I can tell he's been asked to sing it before. He has half an hour left on the clock when Richard makes a show of looking at his watch.
"Holy shit, excuse my French," he says. "It's late and I got church tomorrow."
Everyone laughs. "I'm ready to turn in, too," Lil says. Em smirks.
"Turn into what?"
"Let's blow this joint. I gotta get that thing I left in your room,"
Richard says to Lil, standing up. "What thing?" she asks.
"You know, the thing,"
he says, winking at Em.
"He's gotta get the thing, Lil,"
Em says drunkenly.
"The thing!"
"I didn't know men were allowed in the rooms," I say. Richard rubs his thumb and forefinger together.
"A little grease for the wheel keeps the car running, if you get my gist."
"The desk clerk is easy to bribe," Lil translates. "Just so you know, in case you want to spend some quality time with Dreamboat over there." She and Em collapse and giggles. We make a plan to meet in the lobby of the Women's Hotel tomorrow at noon, and the four of them stand to leave. And then there's a change of plans. Richard knows a bar that's open until 2, and they go off in search of it, the two girls tottering on their heels and swaying against the men, who seem all too happy to support them. Just after midnight, the street outside the hotel is lit up but empty, like a stage set before the actors appear. It doesn't matter that I barely know the man Dutchie has become, know nothing about his family, his adolescence. I don't care about how it might look to take him back to my room. I just want to spend more time with him.
Are you sure?
He asks. More than sure. He slips some bills in my hand.
Here, for the clerk. From the tip jar.
It's cool enough that Dutchie puts his jacket around my shoulders. His hand in mine as we walk feels like the most natural thing in the world. Through the low buildings, chips of stars glitter in a velvet sky. At the front desk, the clerk, an older man now with a tweed cap tipped over his face, says,
"What can I do for you?"
Oddly, I am not at all nervous. My cousin lives in town. All right to take him up for a visit? The clerk looks through the glass door at Dutchie standing on the sidewalk.
Cousin, huh?
I slide $2 bills across the desk. I appreciate it. With his fingertips, the clerk pulls the money toward him. I wave at Dutchie and he opens the door, salutes the clerk, and follows me into the elevator. In the strange, shadowed lighting of my small room, Dutchie takes off his belt and dress shirt and hangs them over the only chair. He stretches out on the bed in his undershirt and trousers, his back against the wall, and I lean against him, feeling his body curve around mine. His warm breath is on my neck, his arm on my waist. I wonder for a moment if he'll kiss me. I want him to.
How can this be?
He murmurs.
It isn't possible. And yet I've dreamed of it, have you?
I don't know what to say. I never dared to imagine that I'd see him again. In my experience, when you lose somebody you care about, they stay gone. What's the best thing that happened to you in the past 10 years? I ask.
Seeing you again.
Smiling, I push back against his chest. Besides that...
Meeting you the first time?
We both laugh. Besides that...
Besides that...
He muses, his lips on my shoulder.
Is there anything besides that?
He pulls me close, his hand cupping my hip bone. And though I've never done anything like this before, have barely ever been alone with a man, certainly not a man in his undershirt, I'm not nervous. When he kisses me, my whole body hums. A few minutes later, he says,
I guess the best thing was finding out that I was good at something. At playing the piano. I was such a shell of a person. I had no confidence. Playing the piano gave me a place in the world, and... It was something I could do when I was angry or upset, or even happy. It was a way to express my feelings when I didn't even know what they were.
He laughs a little.
Sounds ridiculous, doesn't it?
No.
What about you? What's your best thing?
I don't know why I asked him this question, since I don't have an answer myself. I slide up so I am sitting at the head of the narrow bed with my feet tucked under me. As Dutchie rearranges himself with his back against the wall on the other end, words tumble from my mouth. I tell him about my loneliness and hunger at the Burns, the abject misery of the Groats. I tell him about how grateful I am to the Nielsens, and also how tamped down I sometimes feel with them. Dutchie tells me what happened to him after he left the Grange Hall. Life with the farmer and his wife was as bad as he'd feared. They made him sleep on hay bales in the barn and beat him if he complained. His ribs were fractured in a haying accident, and they never called a doctor. He lived with them for 3 months, finally running away when the farmer woke him with a beating one morning because a raccoon got into the chicken coop. In pain, half-starved, with a tapeworm and an eye infection, he collapsed on the road to town and was taken to the infirmary by a kindly widow. But the farmer convinced the authorities that Dutchie was a juvenile delinquent who needed a firm hand, and Dutchie was returned to him. He ran away twice more, the second time in a blizzard, when it was a miracle he didn't freeze to death. Running into a neighbor's clothesline saved his life. The neighbor found him in his barn the following morning and made a deal with the farmer to trade Dutchie for a pig. A pig, I say.
I'm sure he thought it a worthy trade. That pig was massive.
This farmer, a widower named Carl Maynard, whose son and daughter were grown, gave him chores to do, but also sent him to school. And when Dutchie showed an interest in the dusty, upright piano the widower's wife used to play, he got it tuned and found a teacher to come to the farm to give him lessons. When he was 18, Dutchie moved to Minneapolis, where he took any work he could find playing piano in bands and bars.
Maynard wanted me to take over the farm, but I knew I wasn't cut out for it, he says. Honestly, I was grateful to have a skill I could use and to live on my own. It's a relief to be an adult.
I hadn't thought about it like this, but he's right. It is a relief. He reaches over and touches my necklace.
You still have it. That gives me faith.
Faith in what?
God, I suppose. No, I don't know. Survival.
As light begins to seep through the darkness outside the window, around 5 a.m., he tells me that he's playing the organ in the Episcopal Church on Banner Street at the 8 o'clock service. Do you want to stay till then? I ask.
Do you want me to?
What do you think? He stretches out beside the wall and pulls me toward him, curving his body around mine again, his arm tucked under my waist. As I lie there, matching my breathing to his, I can tell the moment when he lapses into sleep. I inhale the musk of his aftershave, a whiff of hair oil. I reach for his hand and grasp his long fingers and lace them through mine, thinking about the fateful steps that led me to him. If I hadn't come on this trip, if I'd had something to eat, if Richard had taken us to a different bar. There are so many ways to play this game. Still, I can't help but think that everything I've been through has led to this. If I hadn't been chosen by the Burns, I wouldn't have ended up with the Groats and met Miss Larson. If Miss Larson hadn't brought me to Mrs. Murphy, I never would have met the Nielsens. And if I weren't living with the Nielsens and attending college with Lil and Em, I would never have come to Minneapolis for the night and probably never would have seen Dutchie again. My entire life has felt like chance. Random moments of loss and connection. This is the first one that feels, instead, like fate. So, Lil demands, what happened? We're on our way back to Hemmingford, with Em stretched out and groaning on the back seat, wearing dark glasses. Her face has a greenish tint. I am determined not to give anything away. Nothing happened. What happened with you? Don't change the subject, Missy, Lil says. How'd you know that guy anyway? I've already thought about an answer. He's come into the store a few times. Lil is skeptical. What would he be doing in Hemmingford? He sells pianos. Humph, she says, clearly unconvinced. Well, you two seem to hit it off. I shrug. He's nice enough. How much money do piano players make anyway? Em says from the back. I want to tell her to shut up. Instead, I take a deep breath and say breezily, who knows? It's not like I'm going to marry him or anything. 10 months later, after recounting this exchange to 24 wedding guests in the basement of Grace Lutheran Church, Lil raises her glass in a toast. To Vivian and Luke Maynard, she says. May they always make beautiful music together. Hemmingford, Minnesota, 1940 to 1943. In front of other people, I call him Luke, but he'll always be Dutchie to me. He calls me Viv. It sounds a bit like Neve, he says. We decide that we'll live in Hemmingford so I can run the store. We'll rent a small bungalow on a side street several blocks from the Nielsens, 4 rooms downstairs and 1 up. As it happens, with perhaps a little help from Mr. Nielsen, who may have mentioned something to the superintendent at a Rotary meeting, the Hemmingford School is looking for a music teacher. Dutchie also keeps his weekend gig at the Grand in Minneapolis, and I go in with him on Friday and Saturday nights to have dinner and hear him play. On Sundays now, he plays the organ at Grace Lutheran, replacing the lead-footed organist who was persuaded it was time to retire. When I told Mrs. Nielsen that Dutchie had asked me to marry him, she frowned. I thought you said you wanted nothing to do with marriage. She said, you're only 20. What about your degree? What about it? I said, it's a ring on my finger, not a pair of handcuffs. Most men want their wives to stay home. When I related this conversation to Dutchie, he laughed.
Of course you'll get your degree. Those tax laws are complicated.
Dutchie and I are about as opposite as two people can be. I am practical and circumspect. He is impulsive and direct. I'm accustomed to getting up before the sun rises. He pulls me back to bed. He has no head at all for math, so in addition to keeping the books at the store, I balance our accounts at home and pay our taxes. Before I met him, I could count on one hand the times I'd had a drink. He likes a cocktail every night, says it relaxes him and will relax me, too. He is handy with a hammer and nail from his experience on the farms, but he often leaves projects half-finished, storm windows stacked in a corner while snow rages outside, a leaky faucet disemboweled, its parts all over the floor.
I can't believe I found you,
he tells me over and over, and I can't believe it either. It's as if a piece of my past has come to life, and with it, all the feelings I fought to keep down. My grief at losing so much, at having no one to tell, at keeping so much hidden. Dutchie was there. He knows who I was. I don't have to pretend. We lie in bed longer than I'm used to on Saturday mornings. The store doesn't open until 10, and there's nowhere Dutchie has to be. I make coffee in the kitchen and bring two steaming mugs back to bed, and we spend hours together in the soft early light. I am delirious with longing and the fulfillment of that longing, the desire to touch his warm skin, trace the sinew and muscle just under the surface, pulsing with life. I nestle in his arms, in the nooks of his knees, his body bowed around mine, his breath on my neck, fingers tracing my outline. I have never felt like this, slow-witted and languorous, dreamy, absent-minded, forgetful, focused only on each moment as it comes. When Dutchie lived on the streets, he never felt as alone, he tells me, as he did growing up in Minnesota. In New York, the boys were always playing practical jokes on each other and pooling their food and clothes. He misses the press of people, the noise and chaos, black Model Ts rattling along the cobblestones, the treacly smell of street vendors' peanuts roasting in sugar.
What about you? Do you ever wish you could go back?
He asks. I shake my head. Our life was so hard. I don't have many happy memories of that place. He pulls me close, runs his fingers along the soft, white underbelly of my forearm.
Were your parents ever happy, do you think?
Maybe. I don't know. Pushing the hair back from my face and tracing the line of my jaw with his finger, he says,
with you, I'd be happy anywhere.
Though it's just the kind of thing he says, I believe that it's true. And I know, with a newfound clarity of being in a relationship myself, that my own parents were never happy together, and probably never would have been, whatever the circumstance. On a mild afternoon in early December, I am at the store going over inventory orders with Margaret, the sharp-eyed accounts manager. Packing receipts and forms are all over the floor. I'm trying to decide whether to order more ladies' trousers than last year, and looking at the popular styles in the catalog, as well as Vogue and Harper's Bazaar. The radio is on low. Swing music is playing, and then Margaret holds her hand up and says, "Wait. Did you hear that?" She hurries over to the radio and adjusts the dial.
"Repeat. This is a special report. President Roosevelt said in a statement today that the Japanese have attacked Pearl Harbor, Hawaii, from the air. The attack of the Japanese has also been made on all naval and military activities on the island of Oahu. Casualty numbers are unknown."
And like that, everything changes. A few weeks later, Lil comes into the store to see me, her eyes red-rimmed, tears staining her cheeks.
"Richard shipped out yesterday, and I don't even know where he's going. They just gave him a numbered mailing address that doesn't tell me anything."
Sobbing into a crumpled white handkerchief, she says,
"I thought this stupid war was supposed to be over by now. Why does my fiancé have to go?"
When I hug her, she clings to my shoulder. Wherever you look are posters encouraging sacrifice and support for the war effort. Many items are rationed. Meat, cheese, butter, lard, coffee, sugar, silk, nylon, shoes. Our entire way of business changes as we work with those flimsy blue booklets. We learn to make change for ration stamps, giving red point tokens as change for red stamps, for meat and butter, and blue point tokens for blue stamps, processed foods. The tokens are made of compressed wood fiber, the size of dimes. In the store, we collect ladies' lightly used stockings for use in parachutes and ropes, and tin and steel for scrap and metal drives. Boogie Woogie Bugle Boy is constantly on the radio. I shift our purchasing to reflect the mood, ordering gift cards and blue onion skin airmail letter forms by the gross, dozens of American flags in all sizes, beef jerky, warm socks, decks of playing cards to go in care packages to ship overseas. Our stock boys shovel driveways and deliver groceries and packages. Boys from my graduating class are signing up and shipping out. And every week, there's a farewell potluck dinner in a church basement, or the lobby of the Roxy, or in someone's home. Judy Smith's boyfriend, Douglas, is one of the first. The day he turns 18, he goes down to the recruiter's office and presents himself for service. Hot-headed Tom Price is next. When I run into him on the street before he leaves, he tells me that there's no downside. The war's an open door to travel and adventure, with a good bunch of guys to mess around with and a salary. We don't talk about the danger. But what I imagine is a cartoon version. Bullets flying and each boy a superhero, running invincible through a spray of gunfire. Fully a quarter of the boys from my class volunteer. And when the draft begins, more and more pack up to leave. I feel sorry for the boys with flat feet or severe asthma or partial deafness who I see in the store after their buddies are gone, aimlessly wandering the aisles. They seem lost in their ordinary civilian clothes. But Dutchie doesn't join the bandwagon.
"Let them come for me,"
he says. I don't want to believe he'll get called up. After all, Dutchie is a teacher. He's needed in the classroom. But soon enough it becomes clear that it's only a matter of time. The day Dutchie leaves for Fort Snelling in Hennepin County for basic training, I take the clatter off the chain around my neck and wrap it in a piece of felt. Tucking it in his breast pocket, I tell him, "Now a part of me will be with you."
"I'll guard it with my life,"
he says. The letters we exchange are filled with hope and longing and a vague sense of the importance of the mission of the American troops and the milestones of his training. Dutchie passes his physical and scores high on the mechanical aptitude test. Based on these results, he's inducted into the Navy to help replace those lost at Pearl Harbor. Soon enough, he's on a train to San Diego for technical training. And when, 6 weeks after he leaves, I write to tell him that I'm pregnant, Dutchie says that he is over the moon.
"The thought of my child growing inside you will keep me going through the roughest days," he writes. "Just knowing that finally I have a family waiting for me makes me more determined than ever to do my duty and find my way home."
I am tired all the time and sick to my stomach. I'd like to stay in bed, but I know it's better to stay busy. Mrs. Nielsen suggests that I move back in with them. She says they'll take care of me and feed me. They're worried that I'm getting too thin. But I prefer to be on my own. I'm 22 years old now, and I've gotten used to living like an adult. As the weeks pass, I am busier than ever, working long days in the store and volunteering in the evenings, running the metal drives and organizing shipments for the Red Cross. But behind everything I do is a low hum of fear. Where is he now? What is he doing? In the letters I write to Dutchie, I try not to dwell on my sickness. The constant queasy feeling that the doctor tells me means the baby is thriving inside me. I tell him instead about the quilt I'm making for the baby, how I cut the pattern out of newspaper and then fine sandpaper, which sticks to the material. I chose a pattern with a woven look at the corners that resembles the weaving of a basket, 5 strips of fabric around the border. It's cheerful, yellow and blue and peach and pink calico, with off-white triangles in the middle of each square. The women in Mrs. Murphy's quilting group, of which I am the youngest member and honorary daughter, they've cheered my every milestone, are taking extra care with it, hand-sewing in precise small stitches a pattern on top of the design. that he completes his technical training and aircraft carrier flight deck training. And after he's been in San Diego for a month, he learns that soon he'll be shipping out. Given his training and the desperate situation with the Japanese, he figures he'll be heading to the Central Pacific to assist Allied forces in that region, but nobody knows for sure. Surprise, skill, and power. This, the Navy tells its sailors, is what it will take to win the war. The Central Pacific. Burma. China. These are only names on a globe. I take one of the world maps we sell in the store, rolled tightly and stored in a vertical container, and spread it on the counter. My finger skims the cities of Yangon, near the coast, and Mandalay, the darker mountainous region farther north. I was prepared for Europe, even its far reaches, Russia or Siberia. But the Central Pacific? It's so far away, on the other side of the world, that I have a hard time imagining it. I go to the library and stack books on a table. Geographical studies, histories of the Far East, travelers' journals. I learn that Burma is the largest country in Southeast Asia, that it borders India and China and Siam.